You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kboo.fm. The time is 4:59. Stay tuned for Wednesday KBOO Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from stateconstitutions.us, committed to empowering people of every state by providing the complete text and audio of their state constitution. Those seeking to hold state governments accountable can learn more at stateconstitutions.us. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Tune in Saturday, June 28th for a live broadcast from Good in the Hood. KBOO will broadcast the entertainment from Lilith's Albina Park from 2 to 7 p.m. Tune in to hear what's good in the hood Saturday, June 28th from 2 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
I'm Monica Beamer.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We are KBOO's new co-station managers. We're excited to be a part of the KBOO community. We're starting a new weekly feature on Wednesdays at 5:45 p.m. News from the Boo will give you an inside look into what's happening at KBOO, including upcoming events, station news, special programming, and future goals and plans for the station.
Be sure to tune in this Wednesday and every Wednesday after the KBOO Evening News for News from the Boo, an insider look into your community radio station.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100-plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank. More information on artists, tickets, and the KBOO broadcast of the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
The conviction. A federal judge rules that bulk email and wireless data collection by the NSA is legal in upholding the conviction against Portland teenager Mohammed Mohammed.
The Portland City Council gives itself a raise.
And the Supreme Court strikes down warrantless cell phone searches by police.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 25th, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. A federal judge has ruled that the Portland Christmas tree bomber's conviction should stand. Mohammed Mohammed was recruited by the FBI for a fake bomb plot in a 2010 sting operation. He was 17 years old at the time that the agents began trying to recruit him. Agents gave him a fake bomb, which he tried to blow up at the Christmas tree lighting in Pioneer Courthouse Square. He had asked for a new trial because the government spied on his emails without a warrant and did not tell him that they had used those emails until after the trial. The judge ruled that the so-called FISA amendments, which allow the government to spy on citizens without a warrant, do not violate the Fourth Amendment protections against unlawful search and seizure. Mohammed is an American citizen. He was targeted by the NSA's bulk surveillance program for emails he sent to non-citizens living in the Middle East. The case has been highly controversial, with many viewing the FBI's so-called sting operation as entrapment. Mohammed is still awaiting final sentencing in the case.
The Portland City Council today voted to give itself a raise. The raise will increase the salary of Mayor Charlie Hales to $63.25 an hour. The four city commissioners will receive $53.27 an hour. This represents an increase of 2.7% from last year's rates. During public testimony on the issue, a local resident identified as Lightning testified that he thought the city council members did not get paid enough.
I have a problem with the bureau directors making more money than the commissioners. Now, you have a lot of bureau directors making over $200,000 a year. And for the commissioners and the mayor not making that money, I think it's not equitable. I think it's not fair. And I think there should be an adjustment. I think that they should do an average like they do at Multnomah County on the bureau of directors, and all the commissioners and the mayor get that much, if not a little bit more. Now, that's my opinion, because I think that your salaries are on the low side, and I really can't understand why you would not be making more than the bureau directors. So I have an issue with that. Thank you.
You and me both. Thanks for bringing that up. It's my intention, I'm interested at some point, and I want to solicit comments from the council and the community about this, to at some point convene a salary commission for the elected officials of the city and have their decisions be applicable to the next set of office holders, because it's, of course, political suicide for, or it would be regarded by some as political suicide for any sitting city council to rectify this problem. But we have over time drifted into a position where the leadership of the city is paid far less than the managers they manage, and that's nuts. And again, we all understand why that situation. It's actually worse in other cities. The mayor of Gresham, a city of about 100,000 people, is entirely unpaid. It's a volunteer position. The mayor of Beaverton is paid quite a bit more than the mayor of Portland. There's absurdity across the board in salaries for elected officials in this state, from the legislature to cities across the state. And it's because sitting elected officials are always very wary, if not completely unwilling, to vote to rectify these kinds of situations once we drift into them. So I think maybe the prescription for that is at some point a commission that looks at this issue and recommends a salary range that applies to the next people that sit in these seats, so that there's no question of self-dealing. There are people who can afford to serve in this office because of their own personal situation. That's great, but we shouldn't rely on that, like apparently Gresham relies on people who have means to serve as mayor. So it's a crazy situation. I appreciate you raising it, and at some point I hope we can figure out a way to do it that will be both reasonable in terms of setting salary levels that make sense and also credible to the community, that people at this dais aren't just feathering their own nest.
Just a comment, Mayor. My salary, I haven't taken a COLA in 4 of my 6 years. I didn't take a COLA, but I make just a little under twice the median family income, and I don't know what's the right mix, but I make a third more than the state treasurer, and that statistic troubles me greatly. There may have been a change recently, but a couple of years ago, the state treasurer, the attorney general, made it in the mid 70s. And I think the governor was making, Steve, how much was the governor making? About 90?
96. Yeah.
96. And it did seem to me odd that the state treasurer, who's responsible for $60 billion of assets, was not eligible for a more competitive salary. And in fact, the governor has said that as a result of his salary, he has been drawing down on his retirement savings to supplement, because his lifestyle being the governor of this state is expensive. And that just seems odd to me. Whether or not we need a raise is a different matter, but I think there are only 2 paid mayors in the state of Oregon, which is also food for thought, because there are some very big cities that have basically unpaid mayors.
I've always thought that the one way you could have salaries at the state level at least become more reasonable would be to like send out referrals to the voters saying a state legislator shall make 72% of the average salary of a registered nurse. And people would agree, well, yeah, they shouldn't get paid as much as the nurse, and that would pass, and they get paid something they could actually live on. And the attorney general shall make 90% of the starting salary of a first-year associate at Stowe Reeves. And people would think, well, that's more than reasonable.
And I don't understand why the attorney general wouldn't be paid commensurate with a first-year judge, for example.
Yeah.
That is also on a public salary. But yeah, anyway, we appreciate the fact that Lightling testified to the fact that he thinks all of us deserve a raise. That's unusual testimony before this body.
Let the record show. Any other discussion before we vote on this? Roll call then, please.
Fish?
Thank you.
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thanks to all our non-represented employees. I get paid a little bit less per hour than I did as a registered nurse, and I think that's about right. Aye.
Hales?
Our represented and non-represented employees tightened their belt to get us through a difficult financial year last year. Now we've returned to a normal cost of living adjustment, and that is as it should be. And I just want to thank everyone, both our non-represented employees and our labor unions, for being really good citizens of the city, getting us through a tough patch. And now this is only reasonable that we make it partially right. Aye.
Not everyone agrees with the assertion that the Portland City Council members and Mayor Hales should be getting raises. The highest paid city employee will be making close to $200,000 a year beginning on July 1st. Portland's cost of living increases for all non-represented employees citywide is expected to cost Portland close to $4 million in the upcoming fiscal year.
Seven new measures are likely to qualify for the November ballot in Oregon. Some of the ballot measures that look to have enough signatures to qualify are as follows. A measure that will create a new primary system in which voters can vote for any candidate regardless of party affiliation. This will also allow independent voters to participate in primary elections. Another measure would require the creation of a fund for enabling young people to pursue a post-secondary education. A third measure would require food manufacturers to label genetically engineered raw and packaged food. This is similar to a measure recently passed in Vermont that's being challenged in court by the food and chemical giant Monsanto. Another ballot measure that's qualified for the November ballot in Oregon would allow the possession, manufacture, and sale of marijuana by and for adults. If passed by voters, Oregon would join Washington and Colorado in allowing the recreational use of marijuana.
An international panel of 29 scientists from four continents have concluded that popular insecticides are largely responsible for the widespread beehive and butterfly die-offs occurring across the United States. The scientists studied over 800 peer-reviewed research papers that have been conducted on pesticides and insecticides affecting beehives. The scientists conclude that insecticides and pesticides containing neonicotinoids are to blame for the mass bee die-offs. Common insecticides sold under commercial names such as Arena, Marathon, Ortho Insect Killer, and Safari all contain the insecticide now known to be a major cause of the bee and butterfly die-offs. The insecticides kill the entire hive when a bee takes nectar contaminated with the pesticide back into the hive. Young bees then feed on the contaminated nectar, killing the entire hive. In the last week, at least five beehives in the Portland area have faced major die-offs due to pesticide poisoning. The Oregon Department of Agriculture is currently investigating and has suspended the license of one landscaping company for violating Oregon law by spraying trees in bloom. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has estimated that over the last 8 years, the annual die-off rate of honeybees is around 30% per year.
U.S. Congress moved today to begin regulating the strain of salmonella that sickened more than 600 people in the recent Foster Farms outbreak. Food safety advocates were angered by the lack of recalls in the Foster Farms outbreak, which began in March of last year and continues until today. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has repeatedly said it lacks the authority to ban salmonella on raw poultry and cannot force a recall. The new bill is called the Pathogens Reduction and Testing Reform Act. It will allow the U.S. Department of Agriculture to recall meat, poultry, or egg products contaminated with bacteria resistant to two or more antibiotics or with pathogens that cause serious illness or death. The previous lack of regulation on these pathogens was a result of intense lobbying by industrial agricultural corporations in the U.S., including Foster Farms. The Center for Science in the Public Interest, which welcomed today's bill, sued the U.S. SDA, the USDA, rather, last month, calling for a ban of four antibiotic-resistant strains of Salmonella, including Salmonella Heidelberg, the contaminant in the Foster Farms outbreak.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the VOO, a discussion about all things KBOO with station co-managers Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw. At 6 o'clock, it's The Underground. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cool and cloudy with a chance of rain in the early morning, a high of 68 and a low of 54. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels are as follows. 34 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 62, 17 counts per minute in Southeast Portland. Vancouver, Washington has a count of 25 counts per minute. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 31. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current average radiation count of 35. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alerts start at 100 counts per minute. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, in 1943, Jews in Czestochowa, the ghetto in Poland, staged an armed uprising against occupying Nazi forces. And on June 25th in 1948, the Berlin airlift began. Our quote of the day is from Vollrain de Clair: humanity cannot be made equal by declarations on paper. Unless the material conditions for equality exist, it is worse than mockery to pronounce men equal.
Five 17 in the Post Meridian. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
From 1776 forward, Americans have opposed having soldiers do police work on our soil. But in recent years, Pentagon chiefs have teamed up with police chiefs to circumvent that prohibition. How? Simply by militarizing police departments. Through the little-known military transfer program, the Pentagon has been shipping massive amounts of surplus war equipment to our local gendarmes. This reflects a fundamental rewiring of the mindset now guiding neighborhood policing. Police chiefs today commonly send out squads brandishing heavy arms and garbed in riot gear for peaceful situations. Recruiting videos now feature clips of SWAT team officers dressed in black, hurling flash grenades into a home, then storming the house, firing automatic weapons. Who wants anyone recruited by that video working their neighborhood? As a city councilman in rural Wisconsin commented when told his police were getting a 9-foot-tall armored vehicle, somebody has to be the first to say, "Why are we doing this?" The New York Times reports that the town's police chief responded that there's always a possibility of violence. Really? Who threatens us with such mayhem that every burg needs a war zone armory and a commando mentality? Astonishingly, a sheriff's spokesman in suburban Indianapolis offered this answer: veterans. The sheriff's department needed a mine-resistant armored vehicle, he explained, to defend itself against U.S. veterans returning from the Afghanistan war. War veterans, he said, have the ability and knowledge to build homemade bombs and to defeat law enforcement techniques. This is Jim Hightower saying that is lame, loopy, insulting, shameful, and just plain stupid. Maybe he just forgot to pack his brain when he left for work that day, but I'm afraid it's a window into the altered mindset of police chiefs and trainers.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have reassigned the director of its bioterror lab. The move comes after the recent exposure of up to 80 employees to potentially deadly strains of anthrax. An investigation continues into how the scientists and other staff were exposed to the disease. Affected employees at the Atlanta campus are currently taking powerful antibiotics, which have a number of side effects. None of the exposed employees are known to have actually contracted anthrax from their exposure.
Half of the customers of Detroit Water and Sewer currently face water shutoffs. Activists say the city seems to be forcing poor people out of the city by starving them of water. Detroit sits in the middle of the Great Lakes watershed, which provides one-fifth of the Earth's fresh water supply. A coalition of human rights groups, including the Detroit People's Water Board, Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, and Blue Planet Project, sent a letter to the United Nations regarding the denial of a basic human right for thousands of people in Detroit. A spokesperson for the utility said that the shutoffs affect only the most delinquent accounts. There is a public hearing this evening about building new infrastructure in the city of Detroit. An 8.7% increase in rates won approval with city council members just last week. KBOO's Kristen Yount spoke with Justin Weeds of the Detroit Water Brigade.
Right now, it is in the news that the Detroit Water and Sewer spokesperson came out and said that half of Detroit's water customers can't pay their water bill. And furthermore, it's not fair to the people who can pay that these people aren't paying. What is going on? Is that accurate?
When they say that half of the city can't afford to pay their water bill, they're absolutely right. And this has reached a nearly crisis situation here in Detroit. As many people know, Detroit's economy has been in decline for quite a long time. The automobile industry, outsourcing, automation. But it has really hit home now with the fact that, as you said, people are unable to pay their water bills. And water, I believe, is a human right. And so when you face a situation where people can no longer afford this public utility, we have to question, how does this system work? And how can we make sure that people's rights are preserved in the face of an economic disaster that we hope does not become a humanitarian disaster?
It's been in the news that people are having their water turned off. Do you know how many people have been shut off already?
Thousands and thousands of people have had their water shut off, Kristen. I want your viewers to know that this is a very, very serious situation. When a water is shut off to a family, there's a whole cascade of effects that can happen afterwards. Children can be taken away by Child Protective Services. Water bills can be assessed against a house as a lien, which can cause tax foreclosure, and people can lose their homes. So you're talking about disastrous, disastrous consequences. And the city is only ramping up this enforcement and claiming that 300,000 people could have their water shut off this summer. And when people can't pay, what are they going to do? Do you want these people to just die? Do you want them to die of thirst? We have to find another way. And we're appealing to the United Nations to intervene here to protect the human right to water. And we're calling on everybody in this country to really focus their attention on Detroit. This is a critical moment for our country when we say, are we going to stand up for the poorest and the neediest amongst us and make sure that people have access to clean water as a basic human right?
Yeah, because if it can happen in Detroit, it can happen anywhere, correct?
That's right. This is just the beginning, and we need to set a precedent for every city. This is the largest municipal bankruptcy in the history of this country, Detroit. And right now, the people, regular working people, are being asked to pay the price for the mistakes and the soured loans of Wall Street and the banks. And what we need to say together is that we won't pay for your crisis, that we need a clean slate, we need a jubilee, a cancellation of these debts so that we can get back to the work of building thriving communities and eliminating poverty, not making poor people pay by shutting off their water and essentially killing them, killing their opportunities to raise their kids and their families. And that's unacceptable in the richest country in the world, and it's unacceptable in any country.
Thank you so much for getting on the air and speaking with us and to our listeners about this incredibly important issue. I want you to tell our listeners how they can get involved and where they can find more information.
Yes, so you can visit DetroitWaterBrigade.org detroitwaterbrigade.org, detroitwaterbrigade.org, and you can sign up to volunteer. Whether you're in Detroit or not, we have all types of needs for volunteers, even if it's just helping spread the word on social media. You can donate to our wedding registry and purchase bottled water, water coolers, water filters, rain catchment systems. We're doing anything we can to help get water to folks in need, and you're really needed in this moment. And if you can come to Detroit, all the better. We'll accept you here with open arms to help serve as a human rights observer and make sure that people's human right to water is being preserved. So visit www.detroitwaterbrigade.org. Thank you so much.
That was Justin Wiedes, an activist and founding member of the Detroit Water Brigade. I'm Kristen Yount for KBOO News.
Tomorrow marks the United Nations International Day in Support of Victims of Torture. The National Religious Campaign Against Torture, a national interfaith human rights organization, is holding a one-day call-in to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. The call-in campaign is focused on the opening of a new high-security federal solitary confinement facility in Illinois, ADX Supermax Thompson. The government agreed to purchase and renovate an unused state prison last year, and funding for the prison was approved in March. ADX Supermax Thompson is set to open by 2016 and would contain 2,100 beds. There's no word yet on how many prisoners at Thompson will receive Special Management Unit classification. That classification includes 23 to 24 hours a day solitary confinement. In 2011, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, concluded that the use of solitary confinement for more than 15 hours at one time constitutes torture. KBOO's Mike Klepfer spoke with the National Religious Campaign Against Torture's Director of Prisons Policy, Reverend Laura Markle Downton, about their campaign.
Can you describe the call-in campaign you have set for tomorrow?
So tomorrow, June 26th, marks the UN International Day in Support of Victims of Torture, and it seems like a fitting day for us to host a national call-in day to Attorney General Eric Holder, to call on him to ensure that we not increase the number of individuals that are victimized and tortured by the use of solitary confinement. What's happening in the Federal Bureau of Prisons is that at a time when the Bureau has actually seen a 5% decline in the population of its ADX Supermax facility, that's the most restrictive form of solitary confinement in the federal system, the Bureau is actually moving to bring online new ADX Supermax beds. Again, what's the most restrictive form of solitary confinement. And so as a result, we are hosting a call-in day to Attorney General Holder to call on him to ensure that the Thompson Federal Prison, which is a federal prison in Thompson, Illinois, that's being brought online, it's a facility with over 1,000 beds. And at a Senate oversight hearing last year, the director of the Bureau of Prisons, Charles Samuels, testified about the Bureau's plans to bring that facility online as an ADX Supermax facility. So we are joining our voices together tomorrow to call to ensure that the facility is not brought online as an ADX Supermax facility. And furthermore, that the Bureau not move to add additional solitary confinement beds in the federal system at a moment when nationally there's broad understanding that the use of long-term solitary confinement constitutes torture, dramatically changes the chemistry of the brain, and is completely antithetical to rehabilitation.
Can you describe conditions in the ADX Supermax system?
There's one ADX Supermax in the federal facility. And again, when I say Supermax, what I'm referring to is a prison that is built solely for the use of long-term solitary confinement, meaning everyone in the facility is in 22 to 24-hour lockdown in a cell alone. Oftentimes, meals are served through a small slot in the door. Oftentimes, individuals are only allowed out of their cell for 1 hour into an exercise cage. all meaningful human contact is denied in those facilities. Now, I mentioned there's one ADX Supermax facility within the Federal Bureau of Prisons. There are over 40 state-run Supermax prisons throughout the United States. It's important to note that in the early 80s, there was only one. When we look into your question, particularly about the conditions in ADX Florence, which is the federal facility in Colorado that is the other facility with this level of security classification, what we have there is an ongoing string of litigation in response to horrific human rights abuses that have taken place within the facility. What's very common when individuals are subjected to such extreme forms of isolation is high instances of pretty egregious forms of self-mutilation, attempts at suicide. We know generally that of all of the completed suicides within our prisons, half of them take place in conditions of solitary confinement.
For people that want to get involved in this campaign, how would they do so?
The first thing I would do is actually encourage folks to visit our website. You can go to www.nrcat, as in National Religious Campaign Against Torture.org. For those that would like to make a phone call to Attorney General Holder for the call-in day, would urge you to do that. You can call the comment line at 202-353-1555.
Well, Reverend Laura Markle-Downson, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is Mike Klepper with KBOO News.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a cloud-based television service, which provides users with content which would otherwise be transmitted as free over-the-air signals, violates the rights of broadcasters. The service, Aereo, provided users with individual antennas, taking the signal from those antennas and streaming the content for users to watch on computers or tablets. Federal rules state that free broadcasts should be made available over the air. Major broadcasters have targeted Aereo for years, saying they profited from content that was not their own. Aereo charged a subscription fee to users. The service previously said that if the court ruled against them, they would shut down. The ruling has been seen as a victory for major media and cable companies.
Last week, the Canadian government approved the hotly contested Northern Gateway pipeline, which would carry diluted tar sands oil from Alberta to the British Columbia coast. Since then, protesters have sat in at one member of parliament's office and chained and padlocked the offices of two others, among other actions against the decision. BC Indigenous or First Nation bands and organizations are generally united against the project, along with Canadian environmental groups and many towns along the pipeline route, as well as the Union of BC Municipalities. Many First Nations groups have vowed to stop the pipeline with physical resistance. The $7.9 billion project, to be built by the Enbridge Corporation, would run 731 miles from Brudenheim in Alberta to Kitimat on the BC coast. KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke earlier today with Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, about his reaction to the pipeline decision.
Mr. Phillip, first, could you say what the Union of BC First Chiefs is?
Yes, the Union of BC Indian Chiefs is a First Nations political advocacy organization. We represent approximately 115 First Nations in the province of British Columbia. The total number of First Nations in the province of British Columbia is 203. So we represent over half. We came into existence in 1969 when the Canadian government under former and now deceased Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau attempted to pass legislation through the Parliament of Canada which would have extinguished or done away with the First Nations people of Canada in the constitutional and legal sense. So Our organization has been around. We're what's known as a rights-based organization. We represent the political voice of First Nations people and are very outspoken on issues of our people in terms of, for instance, social issues like missing and murdered women, as well as opposing large-scale resource development projects on unceded Aboriginal or First Nations territories. There are no treaties in British Columbia. So we defend the rights of our people to defend their Indigenous land rights when it comes to heavy oil pipeline proposals like Enbridge's Northern Gateway pipeline proposal or Kinder Morgan's Trans Mountain expansion proposal. So that's the UBCIC, the Union of BC Indian Chiefs.
So were you at all surprised by the decision to approve the Gateway project?
No, we weren't surprised, but nonetheless, we were deeply disappointed. The Harper government, the Conservative Party of Canada, the government of Canada under the leadership of Prime Minister Harper, has pandered to big oil, big business and industry ever since his government has achieved a majority in Ottawa. And in a very deliberate fashion, the Harper government completely gutted the environmental protection legislation in Canada through omnibus legislation known as bills C-38 and C-45. So the environmental protection legislation was completely gutted.
And I know that some First Nations have vowed not to let the Enbridge Gateway Pipeline cross their territories, cross to the terminal, proposed terminal on the coast. I imagine your organization can't necessarily take a position on such sort of actions, but perhaps you have a personal opinion?
Well, as a matter of fact, many of these communities, if not all of them, are members of our organization. And in that regard, we have formal resolutions passed by our chiefs in assembly that mandate our executive, including myself as president, to stand alongside in solidarity with those communities that have vowed not to let Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline pass through their territories or through the coastal waters of the coastal First Nations or the Haida people. And this battle is now moving into the courts. We have at least five lawsuits that are in the final stages of preparation with another up to another seven that are pending that will directly challenge Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline proposal. And we certainly stand in solidarity with those communities. And if push comes to shove, we may find ourselves out on the land standing in front of bulldozers and physically stopping any site preparatory work, clearing rights away, et cetera, for these pipeline proposals.
That was KBOO's Paul Rowland speaking with a First Nations leader in Canada about resistance to the tar sands pipelines. A bombing in a shopping center in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, has killed 21 people. Dozens were also wounded in the attack. Police say no suspect has been identified and no organization has taken credit. However, the radical Islamic militia Boko Haram has recently stepped up its attacks, mainly in the country's northeast. An April bombing at a bus station in Abuja, claimed by Boko Haram, killed 70. Since 2009, Boko Haram has killed thousands in an insurgency in Nigeria and surrounding states in an effort to create a politically motivated Islamic State. The group came to international attention when they kidnapped over 200 schoolgirls in northern Nigeria in April. Last week, they also kidnapped an additional 60 women and girls and 30 boys in the Borno region.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has asked Parliament to revoke a law authorizing him to use force in Ukraine. Russia had sent unmarked military forces into Ukraine in order to support the country's annexation of Crimea. Russian military forces also supported pro-Russian rebels who seized power in the country's east before passing resolutions declaring the regions autonomous and aligned with Russia. Putin has denied Russian military involvement but has since acknowledged it. Putin's move to deauthorize the use of force is one step in a plan brokered with the interim Ukrainian government in Kiev, which seeks to bring peace to the country. Tensions in Ukraine spiked yesterday when pro-Russian separatist rebels downed a Ukrainian government helicopter, killing nine and putting a separate ceasefire brokered with the rebels in doubt. Russia and Ukraine have been involved in tension since the fall of Ukraine's pro-Russian government in February.
The U.S. government has claimed that Syrian warplanes conducted bombings in Iraq that killed 57 people. Local officials said that warplanes marked with the Syrian flag crossed over Iraq's border on Tuesday, bombing several border towns before flying back. 120 people were wounded in the attacks. The Iraqi government has denied that the attack even took place. The Syrian government has so far refused comment. Syria is currently battling radical militias, including the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, known by the acronym ISIS. Syria's involvement in the war in Iraq would mark the second state in the region to involve itself in the Iraqi conflict. A limited number of Iranian forces have also been sent to Iraq. Fighters with ISIS have taken over numerous Iraqi cities and oil infrastructure as part of an insurgency that has threatened to take over Iraq. Last week, U.S. President Obama said he would send 300 Special Forces troops to Iraq to assist the U.S.-trained Iraqi military, which deserted in large part as ISIS fighters advanced.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.immc.org. For Wednesday, June 25th, 2014. As the Israeli army operation targeting Palestinian communities in Gaza and the West Bank continues, three Palestinian civilians were reported killed. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Wednesday, Amne Mohammed, 62, from the northern West Bank village of Deir Dejan near Nablus city, died on Wednesday afternoon at an Israeli checkpoint. Local sources said that Amne was being transported from her village by a Palestinian ambulance to the city of Nablus after suffering from pain in her chest. Soldiers manning the checkpoint outside the village delayed the ambulance for 30 minutes. While waiting to pass, Amne died at the checkpoint, local news sources reported. Moreover, six Palestinian civilians from two families were injured on Wednesday after troops attacked and searched their home in Yatta village near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Local sources announced that soldiers assaulted six members of Ash-Shawahin and Ar-Rajabi families, including a 13-year-old disabled child, identified as Amir Faris Rajabi. All wounded Palestinians have been moved to a nearby hospital in Hebron city for treatment, the sources added. During the home searches in Yatta, soldiers also kidnapped four men. Another three were kidnapped by Israeli forces during home searches in Hebron city. Also in southern West Bank, Israeli forces invaded the city of Bethlehem and kidnapped four Hamas officials, including two elected legislators. After 14 days of the ongoing military operation targeting the West Bank, Israeli troops have killed seven Palestinians so far, including the two that died today. The Israeli army escalation started on Friday, June 13th, as three Israeli settlers living in an illegal settlement near the southern West Bank city of Hebron went missing. Last week, Israeli troops have killed five Palestinians and kidnapped at least 550 others. In the Gaza Strip, a Palestinian child has been killed when a homemade shell fired by Palestinian fighters accidentally struck her family's home. Medical sources announced that Jude Ad-Danaf, 3 years of age, was seriously injured and died of her wounds later on. She was one of five family members injured in the accident. Also in the coastal region, two civilians were injured and excessive property damage was reported when the Israeli Air Force fired three missiles into a Palestinian naval police center west of the Nusayrat refugee camp, one of the largest refugee camps in Gaza. Meanwhile, F-16 Israeli fighter jets fired at least four missiles into an agricultural area north of Beit Lahia in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, June 25th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Taliban fighters attacked government troops and civilians in five southeastern regions starting this past weekend, killing dozens of people. The fighting has taken place in Helmand Province and four other regions around the border with Pakistan. The Afghan government says 35 civilians, 40 soldiers, and up to 100 Taliban fighters have died. 2,000 families have been displaced in the fighting. Further attacks yesterday include a drone attack of unknown origin in the country's north, which killed four people, and a rocket attack on the Kabul airport, which wounded four people.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zur, David Lessem, Kristen Yount, and Paul Roland. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, Joanne Hardesty hosts a discussion about the over-policing of segments of our community, with a focus on the case of a 9-year-old girl who was handcuffed and taken into police custody last year. At 10:15 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews Joe Walton about her novel My Real Children, the story of an old woman who remembers two lives, two worlds, and two different versions of modern history. At 11:30, it's The Film Show, with news and interviews about the independent film scene here in Portland. Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting your community radio station. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for a live in-studio interview with KBOO's co-station managers. Good night, Brian.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
All right, it is Wednesday, 5:45-ish, which means it is time for our weekly news feature, News from the Boo. I'd like to introduce, once again, KBOO station co-managers Mike Crenshaw and Monica Beamer, who are live with us in the studio. The phone lines will be open for your questions. and we'll be discussing internal workings and future plans of KBOO Community Radio. The number to call in is 503-231-8187. Mike Crenshaw is a conscious hip-hop recording artist, educator, writer, and community activist. Monica Beamer is the former executive director of Sisters of the Road, a local nonprofit group that operates a cafe for low-income communities. How are you all doing today?
Good. How are you?
Great.
Let's start off with the one. Return to the topic of the co-station managership. Now, being a station manager, I know from past experience with other station managers, is a long and hard job. By splitting it up between the two of you, hopefully that leaves you some time for outside interests. What are you engaged in when you're not here at KBOO?
Yes, I am lucky enough to serve as the co-chair of the National Assembly to End Poverty with co-chair Marion Baker Kramer in Detroit. And that's a group that came out of the U.S. Social Forum in 2010 and is working with different groups working at the base to just end poverty, not minimize it, not lower it, but totally end it. So that's a great group. I'm also working on with the Western Regional Advocacy Project. I'm on their board of directors, and we are leading the Oregon and California Homeless Bill of Rights campaigns and exposing and fighting the criminalization of people who are experiencing homelessness in our communities.
And I am a hip-hop artist, a recording artist, so I write, record, produce music, and tour and play live shows. Doing a show this Sunday, Tryon Creek State Park. It's free. It's all ages. Bring the family. We'll be playing in the pavilion. And in addition to that, I'm the political director for Hip Hop Congress, as well as a co-founder of Global Fam and lead organizer for the African Hip Hop Caravan, which is an international project that involves hip hop acts touring different cities on the continent of Africa.
What time is that show at Tryon Creek?
2 to 4 p.m. this Sunday, the 29th.
Excellent.
And something that's important to add, too, is that both Mike and I are on the National Planning Committee for the U.S. Social Forum and really involved in bringing an event to our region and to Portland the last weekend in September, the Pacific Northwest Social Forum. And we just really want to make sure folks know about that. The KBOO Board of Directors endorsed that this past Monday, and so we can find out more on the KBOO website or at pnwsf.org.
We are again speaking with KBOO's station manager, co-managers, Mike Crenshaw and Monica Beamer, live with us in the studio for News from the BOO. If you have any questions for Mike or Monica, the number to call is 503-231-8187. Now, you just mentioned that the board had approved the involvement in the upcoming event, which segues nicely into the next topic, which is board membership. I understand that you're looking for a couple members for the board. What are you looking for specifically, and how can people find out more?
Well, yeah, we are looking. There's so many folks who make KBOO happen, and the board is one group that gives a lot. And so, yeah, we're looking right now. We're looking for folks who are interested in applying. People can find out more basically by going to the website, kboo.fm, and on the right-hand column down at News from the BOO, there's directions about how to fill out the candidate packet, which is due pretty soon. And, yeah, we just really thank anyone who's willing to do that. We're looking for folks who can give 10 to 12 hours per month and with a commitment to KBOO core values of community, progressive perspective, emotional maturity, diversity, leadership, and creativity.
So people shouldn't be afraid if they haven't served on a board before and they don't feel that they have the qualifications that would make a good board member. If they're passionate about it, they should try to get involved.
I think that it would be great to definitely let us know, and we'll we're really excited to see who's interested.
It's a great way to participate in what happens here at KBOO.
I understand we have a caller coming in. We got Brenda on line one.
Hi there. Calling for Monica Beamer. It's Brenda Gersh. I want to help in any way I can with the homeless rights project you have going on. I am totally obsessed with KBOO and La Contessa in her confessional.
Right. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So I heard you were the new board of directors, and I've been hearing you occasionally, but you know who this is, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
it's nice to hear from you. Yeah.
Good. You too. I'm glad you're working for the Boo, because they are really, really, really a great station.
I'm excited. We're excited too. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda.
So yeah, if you want to find out more, you can just email me at kbumonica@kbu.org, or the RAP website is wraphome.org. And
RAP home.
Yeah.
Okay. I will
Great.
Definitely do that.
Great.
Keep up the good work.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brenda. Okay. So you're also looking for a new IT contractor.
That's right. KBOO is looking for an IT contractor to work with our organization 15 hours a week, a competitive hourly wage. And we'd be looking to them to provide on-site IT support, as well as website maintenance support. And for scope of work, application, guidelines, and more info, please go to kboo.fm/hiring.
All right. Well, summer is finally here, although maybe today and tomorrow doesn't feel so much like it is. KBOO traditionally has broadcast lots of festivals and events. I take it that we will be making our presence felt at Blues Fest and the Pickathon broadcast again this year.
Yeah. I was about to say darn tootin', but hey, look there.
That's much better than yes.
Monica, what's happening with Good in the Hood this year?
Right, this weekend is a really important event that we'll be involved in, called Good in the Hood, and this event takes place Friday to Sunday, June 27th to 29th, at Lillis Albina Park, which is at the Harriet Tubman Middle School, located at North Flint and North Russell Streets. And we're going to be there broadcasting on Saturday afternoon, and on Saturday morning we're going to participate in the parade, which we hope folks can join us. The parade actually meets at a different location at 10 a.m. at King School, and that's 4906 Northeast 6th Avenue, with a kickoff at 11 a.m. So we'll make sure all that's up on the website, but we hope folks can join us, or just make sure and go to the Good in the Hood celebration.
And then also coming up on the holiday weekend, July 3rd through 6th, we've got the Waterfront Blues Festival, produced by Oregon Food Bank, co-sponsored by KBOO. That's going to be fantastic. KBOO's been involved with the Blues Fest for years, and this year we've got Greg Allman, Boss Skaggs, Maceo Parker, and Los Lobos all headlining, with also a host of other touring and local acts. Los Lonely Boys, Charlie Musselwhite, Linda Hornbuckle, to name a few. And that's Thursday through Saturday. It's a suggested donation, and Sunday is pass-only admission. So come on down July 4th. There will be fireworks on the waterfront.
Nice.
That would be pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
Actually, I want to skip back one second, just to back to the board information. Mm-hmm. Is there a deadline for submitting board information?
Yes. we're not sure what it
is. You know what?
I'm sorry.
There is a deadline.
July 30th.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sequoia.
And for that and all other information,
please
go to the KBOO website. It will all be there.
The website might say, the reason we don't know is because we're trying to get clarification today. The website has said June 30th, and we do believe it's July 30th.
So. Gotcha.
Yes, yeah. So for more information on these events and many other items, you can go to kboo.fm, and info can be found on the right-hand side of our homepage.
And will the two of you be down at the Blues Festival?
We will be.
Yeah.
So if people want to come down and say hello,
absolutely,
you'll be available.
I don't know that I will be there,
24/7.
Yeah, all 3 days, but I'll definitely be down there one day. So I'd love to talk to folks, say hello.
All right. Anything else to let people know about?
Just thanks to everyone for all what our members and everybody gives to make KBOO happen. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for your support, y'all.
All right. Mike and Monica, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Mike Crenshaw and Monica Beamer, co-station managers here at KBOO. They'll be joining us every week around this time on Wednesdays, and we look forward to hearing from all of you soon. Now, stay tuned for the Underground coming up at 6.
Tune in Saturday, June 28th for a live broadcast from Good in the Hood. KBOO will broadcast the entertainment from Lilith's Albina Park from 2 to 7 p.m. Tune in to hear what's good in the hood Saturday, June 28th from 2 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is Mary Graham. My husband, Donnie Graham, after being down 20 years in prison, was shot and killed by the Clackamas County Sheriff. My four beautiful daughters were taken by the state. I turned to drugs to ease the pain. Listen to my story of healing and hope on Prison Pipeline.
That's Prison Pipeline, June 30th at 6:30 p.m.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Do ba da ba do ba da zaba do ba ba do ba da zaba do ba do ba do ba do ba da zaba do ba 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 do ba da.
I was never cool in school. I'm sure you don't remember me, and now it's been 60 years. I'm still wondering who to be, but I love to mix in circles, clicks, and social coteries. That's me. Hand me my hair gel. Teach me how to twist. We can be happy underground.
Welcome to the KBOO Youth Variety Show. I'm your host as ever, and today our theme is